We've been taking a series of studies in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. We come to the last chapter of Nehemiah, but I propose to take this in two parts, the bulk of the chapter this evening. But when we began with something of an introduction to Ezra some time ago. But I think it is fitting that we would gather a number of elements together, God willing, next week before we conclude these studies. But this evening, to look at, as best we're able and led, to look at chapter 13 and the bulk of the material that we have here. If you haven't done it before, for maybe just for this particular reason, I would actually recommend that you track down one of these programs or a series of maybe clips, YouTube clips or something, that show the funny stuff, you know, the mishaps and the accidents and so on. What I'm especially have in mind is when you see people who fall off of things, and there are times that you have a bit of a laugh at that. Not just when they fall off, but when they fall off because they're trying to lift up something or lift up someone, pull them up. Let's say they're standing on a platform or a rock and there's someone down there and they're trying to get them up. It doesn't go up, they both go down. Now, whether you want to laugh at that or not, it doesn't matter. It's gravity. And in a manner, gravity explains faith as well. Because in many respects, it's easier to get your faith pulled down than it is to pull others up. Quite striking when you look at the prophet Haggai. You're reminded of, and Haggai appeared earlier in this very same period where Nehemiah lived. But you look at the prophet Haggai, and God asks the people a question. And he says, you have something that is holy, the altar, for example, at the temple. When something touches it, does it make that holy? Just any random thing, does it make that holy? And the answer is no. It makes the altar unclean. There's one place in the Bible that we read of that being reversed, and that's the Lord Jesus. He is holy, and nothing can defile him that he makes holy. That's a reversal of all that has happened in the Old Testament. But what you see in Nehemiah is the typical. It is faith being dragged down, rather than the few holy ones and the holy temple pulling others up. Chapter 13 tells us that after a period of time that Nehemiah was with the people in Judah, working away like a ferociously like a beaver, working away to get the wall built and to resolve quite a number of other issues, then he goes back. He had to go back. Time was up. He had to go back quite a long distance away to serve the king again, where he had come from in the first place. And he tells us that during that time, a whole lot of stuff happened. The people started to fall apart, go back to the old ways. He had turned them around, it would seem. They had made solemn undertakings on these very matters, exactly these things. And in his time away, he wasn't there to keep them going. And they fell by the wayside. Hebrews 10:25 tells us that we need each other to keep true to the faith, to encourage one another, to keep us in good courage, which is strength, in love and good works, in what is the Christian life. We have no idea how long Nehemiah was away, but it was long enough for the things that were especially set in place in chapter 10, for these exact things to crumble and to fall apart again. What are these things? And how was it that this happened? First, it was themselves, the people. How did it happen? They seem to have forgotten that they were just not just any people. It happened to the temple. They'd built it themselves. It had been consecrated, set apart, holy to God. And they seem to have forgotten that it was not just any house, any building, any temple, not even any temple. And the Sabbath day, they seem to have forgotten that it was not just any day. And on his return, Nehemiah had to reestablish exactly these things. He had to reestablish that they were a holy people, it was a holy house, it was a holy day. Not just any people, not just any house, not just any day. They were holy. Let's look at those for a moment this evening. They were a holy people. And this is gathering together the first three verses and then also a section from verse 23 down to verse 28. And I mentioned that I would like to return to, as it were, wrap up this series, particularly looking at 29 to the end of the chapter. But a holy people, verses 1 to 3, and then 23 to 28 especially. Most of these people had not long come, maybe when I say it that way, I mean maybe it was they were into their second or third generation, but even that was not very long. They had not long come back from exile in Babylon or thereabouts. And perhaps the Persians who sent them back were thinking of these returning exiles as much the same as any other returning exiles to different parts of the empire, because that's what was happening at the time. Okay, that's where you belong, go there. That's where you belong, go there. Same kind of thing in every group. Why do I say that? It's because having lived in Babylon, having lived under that rule, it's very likely that these people, after 70 plus years, the temptation was perhaps to go along with that same perception. This is the way the rest of the world was looking on these Jews, people of Judah. So let's think of ourselves in the same way. Same as the other groups, same as the other people. For long enough in history, they had failed to hold on to their distinctives as the people of God. Nehemiah had spent some time, Ezra had spent some time, Haggai and Zechariah had spent some time saying, no, that's not you. You are not just any people. You are a distinctive people. But if you don't have someone who cares about it enough, someone who's always talking about it, perhaps we can take the example. If you are going through life and somebody says, I love you, and they keep saying, I love you, you know that you are loved. If that's not happening, many a person, most people, will begin to wonder if they are loved. If somebody doesn't care about it, doesn't talk about it enough, doesn't keep talking about it, maybe you will assume it for a time, but before long that falls away as well. You begin to forget it. And how long you've forgotten it depends on whether someone then comes along and reminds you. It depends too on whether you'll listen to them. When someone comes and reminds the church, we are different. Not a matter for pride, but by God's grace. God's people are different. Are we saying it often enough? It didn't happen there for a spell in Jerusalem because Nehemiah was gone. It's a shame that Eliashib and the others hadn't taken up the task. What Nehemiah found when he returned was that the old problem of the people, the makeup of the people, the interactions of the people, that this had reared its head again. And they were mixing with others. In the first few verses of chapter 13, it doesn't say that that Nehemiah was present, but it is really a continuation of the period around the end of chapter 12, where Nehemiah was there dedicating the wall. So it is really a continuation of that. Verse 4 is where he is doubling back to look on the time that he'd been away. So it would appear that Nehemiah was present, and on this particular occasion, again, reading from the book of Moses, there was a discovery. There was a point made in the books of Moses to keep separate from the Ammonites and the Moabites. These were related to the Israelites. They were descendants of Lot, Abraham's nephew. These verses don't specifically say that they were marrying these people. That comes later. But at least the Ammonites and the Moabites were mingled into the congregation of God in verse 1. So that was something that was had not been registered until now. Later on, verse 23 and following, definitely there was marriage. And again, it was to these very same people. So if the first few verses are when Nehemiah was present the first time, verses 23 to 28 are when he came back. Verses 1 to 3 tell us that they got rid of these people. Verse 23 to 28 says they're there again. Same people, Ammon and Moab, and married in to the people of Israel. Do I need to explain what the problem was so that we can then apply it? The problem is explained in verse 2. Why were the Ammonites and Moabites forbidden to come into the congregation of God? It's because of what they did, or rather didn't do, for Israel. It's what they did to them in the days when Israel was journeying to the land of Canaan. Most children know the story of Balaam and his donkey, where the donkey eventually spoke because the angel had been trying to turn Balaam back from trying to apply a curse against the people. But it's a reminder, as we saw this morning, how there are essentially two parties in this world in opposition to each other. Moab and Ammon, though they were related to Israel, they refused to help. They went even further to try and put a stop to Israel. They set themselves against God's covenant people. They set themselves to curse God's covenant people. I think we recognize as we look at the rest of the Bible that there was no essential problem to a Moabite marrying into Israel if she is a Ruth. Ruth, who said, "Your God will be my God." That's at the heart of the matter. And that was not happening. I'll give you evidence in a moment. That was not happening in the days of Nehemiah with the Moabites and the Ammonites. They were not like Ruth. And so there was an enemy entering into the camp. There was a real live contemporary case of that, not just going back to the days of Ruth or the days of the wanderings in the desert. A real case right in front of them, right there. We see in a moment how Tobiah was living right in the heart of this city, God's city. Who was Tobiah? Tobiah, you read about him in chapter 4. He was one of the party that was doing everything in their power to stop the building of the wall. He laughed at the people. He sent armies against them. And who is Tobiah? Tobiah is an Ammonite. Tobiah, we read later on, was the son-in-law in the high priest's family. His partner Sanballat had married into the high priest's family. Right in the heart, right in the center of the life of this people who bore God's name. Very people. Do you remember the story of Balaam? Three times God gave Balaam a blessing to put on Israel. Because those three times Balaam wanted to curse them so that he could get some money from the Moabites and the Ammonites. These are enemies. And they were right in the very heart. They were in the families. They were in the temple, right in the very heart of the people. When you go down to those marriages to the people of Ammon, Moab, Ashdod, you might remember, were the Philistines. Some of the most amazing stories of the Old Testament, the Philistines against Israel, dead against them, doing everything they could to tear them apart, doing them no favors whatsoever. These were married into the people. And so what does Nehemiah do? Quite spectacular solutions. Verse 25, contended with them, cursed them, struck some of them, pulled out their hair to make them swear by God, bind them to this. And he had, with those spectacular solutions, he had irresistible objections. How can you do this? It seems to me that the few words that we have recorded here tell me of a deep-seated horror that Nehemiah has when he sees this happening. How can this possibly be? Don't you know about Solomon? Time and again we've done this, and God has been gracious to us, but what are we doing? Further on into verse 27, he says, should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women? And there was one particular example, which I mixed up there a moment ago, but in the family of the high priest, and this particular one of the sons of Joiada, I drove him from me. No half measures, because of his horror of the direction that things had taken. How can this possibly be? Friends, I've said repeatedly as we've been going through Nehemiah, this was the people of God. The people of God today is his church. It's not a particular nation in the same way. I can't go into all that is involved in Israel as the covenant people, but primarily, it is the church. What does the church need to hear from this? First, that we are not just any people. We are God's people. And so often in our culture, we deal with things individually. We need to remember that we're not just individuals. What Joiada or his son did affected everybody. That's why he was driven out. It still applies today. When you trust in Christ, you are brought into a people of God, a people, joint, bound together. What one does has an impact on others. Not just in our church here, yes, in our church here, but not just here, but throughout the world. And if there's any difficulty in thinking how this applies within our own fellowship or the slightly wider fellowship that we might be aware of, stop and think for a moment. What does this mean to the pastor in Pakistan, or the mother or the daughter in Iran who is in prison because they say, I trust in Christ and I will not let him go, and the suffering that they bear for his name? What does this mean if we forget that we're not just any people? If we forget that we're God's people, and that there are things that do not belong in God's people, mixed with God's people? I've titled this Demanding Holiness. It is demanding. But that's why Nehemiah was demanding as well, because he could see that it's God we're dealing with. The Most High, the God who is holy. If you or I choose to mix something in, an extraneous element, something that doesn't belong, are we helping the people of God? Are we honoring our God in this and all the different aspects of our lives? I need to move on. A holy house. In Nehemiah's absence as well, from verse 4 onwards, he gets straight into the point. While he was away, it tells us in verse 6, during all this, I was not in Jerusalem. It happened in his absence. Eliashib the priest, not necessarily the high priest, but maybe another with the same name, who had particular responsibility over the storerooms of the temple, he had an alliance with Tobiah the Ammonite, and he gave him a large room. One of these great enemies of God's people gets prime real estate in the heart of God's people. Fair-sized room, storeroom, and there's a pile of things that were normally kept there, but not just any things, very precious things, very holy things. These were the things that were commanded, in verse 5, commanded to be given to the Levites and singers and gatekeepers and the offerings for the priests. And these, it wasn't just for the men, Levites, priests, gatekeepers and so on, these are described elsewhere as offerings to the Lord, which are then to be allocated to these men doing the Lord's work. This is in the temple, in the house of our God, a place meant for God's service. I'm thinking it's almost like an executive of Unilever having a pass to Procter & Gamble and having an office there. Only this is on a far greater scale. It's an issue of holiness. It's not just a commercial opposition or competition. This is an Ammonite of the people who set themselves against God. Nehemiah says in verse 7, I discovered the evil that Eliashib had done. In verse 8, it grieved me bitterly. In verse 9, he speaks of the need to cleanse the rooms. They'd been defiled. This was no ordinary temple of the other gods. This one's different. It was no ordinary building. It was the house of their God. Why did Eliashib do this? For convenience? Tobiah says, it would be really helpful if I could have an office in the city. Doing him a favor? Not wanting for Tobiah to come back and say, so what's wrong? Don't you like me, or I'm going to cause trouble for you? Why? We don't know. But one thing is missing. One thing was not said to Tobiah. No, you do not belong here. This is the house of God. These things are for God. The first things concerning this place were forgotten. Not mine to do with as I like. Not even the church's to do as the church likes. It's for God to direct and for us to obey. The application today is that we're not only God's people, we are God's house. Peter says, you as living stones are being built up a spiritual house, a house for God to live in. This is us as well. It's not that we have to stand aloof from everything of this world, but we need to know the limits. It strikes me that the temple generally over the years had a court for the Gentiles. In a sense, someone like Tobiah had a place he could come to should he wish to worship God, but only there. A devout Ammonite might enter there, but one who was an avowed opponent, one who had already demonstrated what his heart was towards these people, he was trying to stop them building a wall, and now next thing you know, Nehemiah finds him in a room, in this place, a precious room. What about our life as a church? And the elements, the members of the church, you and me, what are you giving room to? What is the spirit of this person, this thing? Does it match with God's honor? Does it uphold God's holiness? What does it do to God's honor in your life and heart? We must examine these things. I know that Jesus said at one point, he who is not against us is for us. But in a context more like this one, he also said, he who is not for me is against me. We must answer this. Who we are, what we do, is it for God's glory? Is it the way that God has established things? Not for us to say, what will society think of us? Not to say, what does society think we should do? And that is very prominent in many parts of the church. We need to guard against it. The other aspect of this is the impact it had upon the rest of the service. I've talked about what you do has an impact throughout the church. It certainly did in that place. Nehemiah also realized from verse 10, and it's hardly surprising when the place was not there to gather the offerings and the gifts and things. Where were people to put them? Where were they to be stored? So the things were not gathered. People were not making their offerings. So what did the servants of the house of God do? They ran back to their fields and their cities. In verse 10. They had to abandon the work of the temple, the house of God, just to make a living. Now I know that Paul made tents, but very limited, in the very infancy of one of the churches we read of. But he also made it very clear that he, as a servant of God's house and people, he had rights that he could have called on to be provided for, as the Levites and the priests did, or had a right to. If the people of God are to serve God well, God has his particular servants, and they were not there. It would seem to me that this is a double blow to the people. There were those good things. It looks to me like one of these, a cuckoo chick moment, where the cuckoo lays an egg in another bird's nest. When the chick hatches, it gets big very quickly, and it kicks out the real bird, the real chicken. It's a usurper. It pushes its way in. That's what Tobiah did, and shoved out the good things. Unclean had come in. The cleansed, the consecrated, was pushed out, all in the same blow. Because they forgot. This was not just any building, it was a holy house. Much more briefly, a holy day. The third part, not that it's insignificant by any means, and there are quite a number of verses given over to it which remind us of that. But from verse 15 down to verse 22, it speaks about the Sabbath day. And it begins, first of all, with people of Judah themselves going about their ordinary business, perhaps as the Persians did, the Babylonians that they had once lived with. We read this morning in Exodus chapter 31 of the special emphasis that God gave to the Sabbath day. It was a covenant sign, it was a covenant in itself of their exceptional place before God, taking them back to their release from Egypt, the house of bondage. Remember, they were slaves in Egypt. They did not have a rest day. God released them, and he gave them a rest day, gave it back. How often we're hearing these days or finding these days that the one day of rest in seven is being used for all sorts of things. And it's suggested to us we shouldn't put limits on it. But it is a freedom. It's a freedom from the pressures of everything that goes on. The number of times that you hear other people who go on and go on and go on, Monday to Friday and Saturday and Sunday, their lives are packed full and they're worn out. And God releases us from that. Some time ago, the people had recognized that. Just back in chapter 10, they had signed an undertaking to, amongst other things, maintain the Sabbath as God had put it in place. And so soon they fell asleep. Their own people were working and trading. Foreigners were doing it. Who knows, perhaps it had come about because the foreigners had started. And so, well, if they're going to make money on this day, we need to join in, keep up. We can't be sure, but it's a very common pattern for these things. Yes, Jesus said, the day is made for man. It's for us. It's for our good. And we don't usually get that by just doing what we feel like doing. But let's look at what God says. What is his pleasure? And we'll find that is man's good. That's how God made the day. And why he gave it to the people. And don't we have all the more reason? We also look forward to a rest through the resurrection of our Lord Jesus. And again, Nehemiah sets about with a very strong solution, very strong words, takes action in support of them. He gives very severe threats, "I'll lay hands on you." And then he steps out and he sees to it that the gates are shut. Words themselves are often not enough, but he puts these things in place so that the day itself would be sanctified once more in verse 22. So friends, there is indeed a great deal, and I really have just skimmed through this chapter. Such standards of holiness in our day, as they probably were then, it would appear to be very demanding, quite stringent, if you look at them in a certain way. But not the way that Nehemiah looked at them. Not the way of covenant, which they had reaffirmed back in chapter 10 as a people. Not God's way. It's into a place like this, a time like Nehemiah's, a time like ours, that the challenge of Elijah comes again, where he said to the people of Israel, "How long will you waver between two? If the Lord is God, worship him," meaning serve him. It's an immense privilege to be a holy people and a holy house. It's an immense privilege to have a holy day, because the Lord is God and he is holy. It's because of that that Nehemiah did demand holiness from the people. He was very demanding. I certainly wouldn't have that courage. I'm not that kind of person. He was. To go pulling people's hair out and giving them a beating and sending somebody packing out of the city at first notice and threatening people, I'm going to lay hands on you. But he demanded holiness from the people, and why not? What were they saying by the way that they behaved in his absence? God doesn't care. But God, does God not care? He believed God did. And so we come towards the end of this book, and we see repeatedly at every moment, every point where he's dealt with an issue, he says, he pleads, Lord, remember me for good. And that's what I want to come back to, God willing, next week. Whatever appearances may be, that God hadn't struck them down the moment they did it the first time. He knew that all things would be revealed, that this was bringing them right to the brink of further danger under God's wrath. He knew that all these things would be accounted for. And that's one of the great things about Nehemiah. Yeah, he was a very organized man and so on, but that's not the main thing. It's just his passion for God and God's people. As with Moses, Lord, don't eliminate this people. For the sake of your own name. And what grace and mercy came upon the people as a result. Yes, Nehemiah would have to give account for his stewardship of his as a leader, but he was passionate about these people, that they shouldn't decline and fall back once more. He made a fool of himself, but it was for the salvation of the people. Hebrews 12:14 says, pursue holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. May he bless his word to each of us where we are in our standing before God this evening and his church.